gratitude goes out to you today for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. This is a locally made exploration into positive solutions to some of today's ecological challenges for all of us working to create a healthier future for our communities and for the world you live in.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. My name is Darnell. On today's show, four KU students currently enrolled in KU's Environmental Study Capstone course have prepared a special broadcast concerning the current issues with the American energy grid and possible solutions. We at Eco Radio are glad to encourage awareness and protection of our world. We can create a sustainable present for a sustainable future. This will be a great radio hour, but first, the environmental news for the week of March 29, 2021. Democracy Now! Reports 14 Republican state attorney generals are suing the Biden administration over its moratorium on new oil and gas leases on public lands and water. A new report has revealed the world's 60 largest banks lend more than $3.8 trillion for fossil fuel projects since 2016 following the signing Paris Climate Agreement. Top lenders, including J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Citibank, and the Bank of China. New York Times report, President Biden's economic team is finalizing plans to invest trillions of dollars in spending and tax credits to lift the economy. Tackling climate change and shifting to clean energy will underpin virtually every part of the package. Fixing climate change is at the heart of the economic plan. The Keystone XL pipeline might not run through your backyard, but there are probably other important environmental issues up for debate in your community, and it can be hard to find out about them. It might be more effective to join a local environmental advocacy organization. Inside Climate News reports, the Interior Department has reversed the Trump administration's decision determining that a portion of the Missouri River was under the jurisdiction of the state of North Dakota rather than a Native American reservation. The Black Jewel Coal Mining Company can walk away from cleaning up and reclaiming coal mine covered by more than 30 permits in Kentucky under a bankruptcy liquidation agreement. About 170 other Black Jewel permits in Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and West Virginia will be placed into legal limbo for 6 months while Black Jewel attempts to sell them to other coal mining companies. Any permit that are unable to be transferred can then also be abandoned by the company. Once the nation's sixth largest coal producer, the ruling will go into effect after the bankruptcy court judge signs a final order. According to a new study, summer weather could grow to half a year in length by the end of this century if no mitigation efforts are done on climate change. In about the past 60 years, summers has increased by 17 days on average across the globe. The EPA said it would carry out an accounting of political interference in science under the Trump administration, an unusual public act that the Biden administration officials said was needed to restore trust in the agency's decisions. The U.S. Energy Department Secretary Jennifer Granholm announced an aim to cut solar energy costs by 60% by 2030. E&E News reports, a group of environmental organizations organization is asking the EPA to exercise its authority to crack down on forever chemicals by blocking any further approval of the substances. Recent reports show that a pesticide widely used for mosquito control contains the so-called forever chemicals, including a noxious compound phased out of U.S. production years ago due to health concerns. Now our show.
On this hour of Eco Radio KC, we're going to hear from four students currently enrolled in KU's Environmental Studies Capstone course. Sloan, we're going to start with you. Welcome.
Hi, welcome to today's hour of Eco Radio. My name is Sloan Sproul.
My name is Madison Hain.
My name is Hannah Neust.
And I'm Eleanor Walsh.
And we are here today with you as four students at the University of Kansas who are studying environmental studies. We wanted to come on today and kind of take what we've learned, what we think, and how we feel about what we're interested in, and come around to be able to look at the future and talk about how that can relate to today's crises through Eco Radio Hour.
Yes, and we are here today because the four of us are all enrolled in a capstone course that we take as part of our environmental studies major. And in the capstone course, everyone does a community-based group project. And so ours was to come on this show and to do research on a particular topic and tell everyone all about it. And so we would just like to give a big shout-out and thank you to our professors for that course, Ali Brox and Kelly Kincher, as well as our graduate teaching assistant, Lauren Stitch, for all of your help and guidance this semester.
We also want to take this time to thank Teresa Wilkie and all the other hosts here at Eco Radio for working with us throughout this process and for being willing to host students on the podcast. This has definitely been a really cool opportunity for us.
So, given the crisis that happened in Texas this February, we wanted to come on and discuss some of the current problems with our electricity grid, why crisis is more likely to happen more and more due to climate change, and how we can make our grids and the communities that rely on them more resilient.
Although we are not professionals in these subjects, we want to take this time to educate listeners on our understanding of the electric grid, its challenges, and potential solutions.
So just in case you missed what was going on a couple weeks ago, Eleanor, do you want to give us a quick rundown about what was happening in Texas?
Yeah, thank you, Sloan. So mid-February around the 11th, Texas started to see some icy and frigid temperatures, which over the next week spiraled into a historic winter storm in Texas. Not only were Texas roads and services underprepared to handle this type of winter weather, but a series of crises popped up during the following weeks. Texas has its own power grid. It's something many of their politicians are very proud of, but it proved to not be efficient enough in serving its communities and people when the power grid started to fail over the following weeks. And many people were out of power for many days. As the Cut magazine concluded, the power grid could not meet the demand of so many people scrambling to heat their homes, nor was it equipped for a weather event of this magnitude. Sadly, at least 57 people died during the winter storm because of either carbon monoxide poisoning, car crashes, drownings, house fires, or hypothermia. Alongside this, millions had no access to clean water, pipes were bursting, boil water notices were sent out, and there was very little response from Texas legislators. Later on, though, Greg Abbott, the state's governor, did eventually apply for a federal emergency declaration and was able to receive emergency aid. I think a positive note to end on that we will discuss more later is how mutual aid efforts in cities in Texas, alongside the help of donations from all over the country, provided for communities and genuinely saved people's lives during this winter storm crisis. So, this was all over the news. What did you guys see about the Texas situation from here in Kansas?
I feel like, honestly, most of what I was seeing was the politicization of the crisis and this, like, battle between how red states and blue states handle their infrastructure. Did anyone else see, like, that competition?
Yeah, I saw a lot of slander coming from people saying, oh, well, Texas is a red state. This is them getting what they deserve. But I think that's so backwards. And clearly we see that this crisis was devastating to their people. And I just don't think that's a constructive attitude to be taking during an energy crisis.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot of like, well, this is what happens when you vote red. But it's like, is this what happens? You know, I mean, Madison, you'll be able to talk more about how this is how the politicization of this issue can really come to be.
Definitely. For now, Eleanor, do you want to tell us a little bit more about what you learned about rolling blackouts?
Yeah, I feel like that was a phrase that we heard a lot in the news, even here in Kansas where we had some rolling blackouts. So in case you don't know, rolling blackouts are controlled power outages that are supposed to last a short amount of time. In theory, this is supposed to prevent energy grid from collapsing completely, but many Texans were still without power for like a number of days. And I don't know what other people would consider that, but I consider this a failure of the energy grid because Texas failed to winterize their energy grids and systems, so they had to resort to blackouts, which in turn lasted much longer than expected. So in some situations, states can buy power from neighboring states because they share energy grids, but since Texas has its own energy grid, they couldn't utilize this resource. And I feel like this is where the argument for a more resilient and environmentally sound energy grid comes in. So, again, we'll touch more on these community efforts that made a huge impact on Texas communities later on in the podcast.
Thank you, Eleanor. For the remainder of our time in this section, we'll be diving into a basic background on what the American energy infrastructure looks like and therefore why we see the issues of energy crisis that we do today. Then we will look more into the politics of utilities and offer some potential solutions in light of increasing mutual aid efforts across the country.
First, we will have Hannah discuss what she knows about the current state of the energy grid, and she will explain some of the ways that climate change can impact the ability of the grid to function.
Great. Thank you, Eleanor. So a little bit about the current state of the grid. We get our electricity from a variety of sources, both from different fossil fuel sources and renewable sources. And in the United States in 2020, 40% of our electricity came from natural gas. About 20% came from coal. About 20% came from nuclear. And another 20% came from all sources of renewable energy combined. So that would include wind, solar, hydropower, and more. And over the last several years, we have seen coal largely phased out and replaced more and more with natural gas, which is a lot less carbon intensive. And we're seeing an increasing proportion of electricity coming from renewable energy. So that has been increasing, even though it's only at about 20% in the United States right now. But in Kansas, on the other hand, we actually got a full 41% of our electricity from wind power in 2019. And that's even more than we got from coal or from any other single source. And most of the rest of our electricity in Kansas came from coal, natural gas, and nuclear power. And because most of our electricity in the United States comes from fossil fuels, electricity production is a major contributor to our nation's carbon emissions and therefore climate change. So lots of people want to see our grids rely less on fossil fuels or get rid of fossil fuels altogether. The city of Lawrence, for example, is actually planning to get 100% of its electricity from renewable sources by the year 2025. And President Biden has the goal of completely decarbonizing the grid by 2035. So this means that all of our electricity would come only from renewable sources like wind and solar. And this is in addition to decarbonization efforts in other sectors, such as transportation. And in order to decarbonize transportation, we would have to electrify our transportation, which would mean expanding the grid and making changes to it even more in addition.
Eleanor?
I don't know about you guys, but I feel like energy is a much larger discussion these days. I don't know if it's just because I'm not a kid anymore or I actually watch the news these days, but I feel like many municipalities like Lawrence are creating more comprehensive energy plans, and it's super exciting from an environmental perspective to see some progress.
I agree with that, Eleanor. Personally, I really like the sound of trying to electrify our transportation and expand on public transportation, because it definitely seems to be lacking right now. But thank you for that, Hannah. We're going to take a short break now for some announcements, but stick around, because when we get back, we'll be discussing our thoughts on the future of the grid.
Extinction Diaries, More than 3,500 endangered sea turtles were rescued in Texas during the February 2021 cold snap that crippled the state. Sea turtles were experiencing cold stunning, where the turtles become unable to swim or feed. The rehab Sea Turtle Incorporated is located on South Padre Island in southern Texas. By day four of the freeze, they had rescued 2,500 turtles. At the end of the same day, another 1,000 turtles were rescued and brought to the town's convention center, where they were warmed up in tubs, tarps, and kiddie pools. Game wardens and community volunteers worked to extract turtles from the Brownsville Ship Channel and surrounding bays. The turtles were at the mercy of power outages, and the convention center was relying on generators and alternative heat sources. Five Texas sea turtle species are listed as endangered and affected by the cold storm, along with every other species of wildlife in the region. Many animals have died. The efforts of this single event is a hint as to the amount of attention all humans must turn to saving all species from the sixth great extinction. My name is Arna Oliveira, and this is a Small World Radio production.
The Midwest Trust Center at Johnson County Community College, in support of KKFI, is presenting the Homegrown Soul Review, virtually March 26th through April 11th. Homegrown Soul Review is a St. Louis-based initiative that gives musicians a way to perform so enthusiasts can support artists and venues like the Midwest Trust Center. Performers include Brian Owens, The Mighty Pines, and Joanna Sorenko from NBC's The Voice. That's the Homegrown Soul Review through April 11th. Learn more at jccc.edu/Midwest Trust Center.
Let's explore, let's question, let's decolonize together on Ebony's Bones.
Tune in every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Nature Note with Angela Gibbons of Earthwalk Vermont.
Today I'm feeling thankful for early spring, and skunks are coming out. Striped skunks do not hibernate, but instead, from November through March, they are dormant. This means that skunks have been in a torpor, a kind of deep sleep. They awaken from time to time and may go out to forage. The skunk has had a lean winter diet of carrion, fruit, and seeds. In spring, the diet is rich in insects and small mammals. And yes, sometimes our garbage or compost. As the weather warms, you will, or maybe already have, smell the skunk. Though don't be confused by the scent marking of a red fox, which has a very skunky odor, especially strong in early spring. Look for skunk or fox tracks or other signs in the snow to help tell the difference. Striped skunks generally hang around and move pretty slowly because they don't have many predators. However, a great horned owl makes a perfect predator for a skunk. The owl has no sense of smell. Another reason skunks are coming out is because it is time to find a mate. From late February through early April, the skunks are pairing up. After mating, females establish dens, sometimes communally, to raise their young. Males spend warm months alone. So, in late April to early June, little baby skunks will come into the world.
To find some food, oh, skunks are coming out. Ooh, they're coming out, skunks.
Nature Note comes to you weekly from earthwalkvermont.org and Goddard College Community Radio.
Hi, welcome back to this hour's program of Eco Radio. Again, I'm Sloan Sprout, and I'm here with three other students from KU's Environmental Studies program, and we're here to discuss just a few of the complicated issues surrounding the American energy grid, especially given the recent energy disaster that has happened in Texas.
In this segment, Hannah will continue to tell us about how the grid will be continued to affect by climate change. And then Sloan will talk about her understanding of why energy crises exist and who they affect the most.
Thank you, Madison. So when we talk about the relationship between the electric grid and climate change, we usually talk about the effects of the grid of our power generation on climate change. Of course, we know that burning of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas for electricity emits greenhouse gases and heats the planet. However, we do not often talk about how climate change itself is going to affect the grid. Scientists expect severe weather and extreme weather events to become more and more common due to climate change. And as we know, extreme weather events can lead to outages. hotter summers will increase power demand as we need cooling for our homes, which can also make blackouts more likely. Now, our power plants and electricity infrastructure can be pretty vulnerable to more severe weather, especially flooding, storm surge, and rising sea levels in coastal areas. But these types of weather events and weather conditions are not the only threat to the grid from climate change. Climate change is actually likely to make some types of power more difficult to produce. Much of our electricity currently comes from thermoelectric power plants that are powered by coal, natural gas, and nuclear power. And these thermoelectric plants require large amounts of water to run. Climate change is going to alter the hydrologic cycle, the water cycle, and is expected to make some areas drier and more drought-ridden. So some of these power plants are going to suffer from less access to water. And the quantity of water is not actually the only thing that matters here. Thermoelectric plants need water at a particular temperature, and water that is too hot makes the plants less efficient. Now, wind and solar energy, on the other hand, generally require little to no water to produce electricity as compared with coal or natural gas or nuclear power. So wind and solar are less likely to be hurt by droughts and drier conditions. But wind and solar energy can be affected by climate change in other ways, though. After all, these types of energy depend on weather conditions. Wind turbines need wind, of course. Solar energy needs sunlight, which can be difficult or impossible to get if it is cloudy or if it's nighttime. So how then are wind and solar availability going to change with climate change? We'll start with wind. So climate change will likely change how often it gets windy and how windy it gets, and this effect will vary across the country and will vary seasonally. So it's not going to look the same everywhere in the United States, and it's not going to look the exact same year-round. So some places are likely to have greater wind energy availability, while others are likely to see reduced wind energy availability. A 2018 paper written by members of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and the National Center for Atmospheric Research looked at a bunch of studies and found that, for the most part, they predicted climate change to decrease wind resources in more places than it would increase them. They did find, however, that wind energy density could increase by up to 10% in Kansas as a result of climate change. In general, though, there is a lot of uncertainty over how wind energy is going to be affected by climate change. So what about solar power then? Now, one of the biggest challenges with solar power is cloud cover, because, of course, with cloud cover, we can't get as much sunlight. And climate change is going to affect cloud cover as, again, it affects the water cycle. And as with wind power, the effects of climate change on cloud cover and therefore solar energy availability is likely going to vary from place to place. And as with wind, there is a lot of uncertainty over how exactly climate change is going to affect solar power, except that solar availability is likely to improve in some places and to worsen in others. So how then does the grid need to change along with climate change to prepare for this? Even without considerations of meeting emissions goals, it would be smart to shift over to sources like wind and solar, and away from more water-intensive sources like coal and natural gas, as water availability will become more strained under climate change. We need to continue improving battery storage for wind and solar energy so that we can store energy when it is produced in excess and have it available for when the sun isn't shining or for when it isn't windy. And this is going to be especially important if we are going to make our grid more dependent on renewables and if we want wind and solar to be prepared for potential climate change challenges. And so I think now we are going to have Sloan give us more information about the societal structures behind electric power.
Before we switch into that, Hannah, I was wondering, do you think our domestic and personal energy uses have a big impact on the grid, or do you think it's more the energy supply itself?
So that's a great question, Sloan. Our usage of energy is naturally going to have an effect on the grid. And so I think for anyone who wants to find ways to lower their personal electricity usage, I think that's a great thing. That's a wonderful choice. But our problems with the grid and our problems with blackouts and outages like we've had are a lot bigger than our personal choices, than our personal individual choices. I think there's a lot more structural problems, which I think we'll learn a lot more about from what you have today.
I was just about to say that's like a perfect segue into what I'm going into. So kind of like why does the grid fail? Why do we have these blackouts? The short, easy answer is that our energy supply has become incredibly weak due to peak oil and political instability, as well as compounded by issues such as global warming, a shift to renewable resources, as well as harsh infrastructural neglect that has let our energy system essentially just be degraded by time or transitions or anything, and just kind of leaving things not up to where they are, where they should be. But another thing that's weighing heavily on the energy grid is the demand from our growing population, especially in with rising levels of consumer influence and like energy addictions is what some of the research has said. So like air conditioning, especially, it accounts for 20% of domestic energy usage, and it can really create a feedback loop with climate change. Kind of as much the more energy we use, the more emissions are going to be made, the worse climate change is going to be. Therefore, we're going to need more air conditioning, kind of creating a feedback loop where climate change and air conditioning are a little bit dependent on each other, as well as, honestly, a big transition into electric vehicles is putting a bit more strain on the energy grid than it used to. So the energy grid itself, what does it mean when it fails? So it has been listed as critical infrastructure by the International Risk Governance Council because it is a large-scale human-built system that supplies continual services critical to society's functioning. And actually, the American Society of Civil Engineers has predicted that the generational system in the U.S. will collapse by 2020 without significant investment. They even predicted as early as 2014 for Texas, which seeing that a little bit now is kind of creepy. But what happens when we have blackouts? Because it's not just like you don't have power in your house. There's massive food waste, just all perishable items in food in grocery stores or restaurants aren't being properly kept or refrigerated because we need energy for that. Blackouts actually will increase crime as a lot of security systems are relying on energy. And then because of this increased risk of crimes, a lot of times cities will put extra police out there, which we all know can lead to social unrest and greater issues of civilian unrest and power struggles. There's also traffic jams and incidents with the halting of transportation as lights are out and public trains or light rails don't work. And then when some people who can afford to not deal with the blackout, they'll be able to buy a diesel generator and power their home. Not only does this emphasize class differences, but it creates a lot of noise and air pollution. So we know that these blackouts are a consequence of overconsumption and our addiction to energy use, but unfortunately, those who are over-consuming, getting those diesel generators, relying heavily on air conditioning or electric vehicles aren't the people who are most affected. It's the areas that have the least, are the most affected and lack investment of critical infrastructure are most often low income and indigenous communities. So it kind of shows more about like the people in power aren't often representative of those communities and therefore aren't willing to support those communities in certain events. In summation, the energy grid is incredibly fragile, and we're going to need to make investments to our infrastructure unless we want to lose about $25 billion to $180 billion per economic loss per year. Without electricity, our economies will start to self-destruct.
Thank you, Sun. Those are some serious numbers, and I'm definitely on board with investing in our infrastructure. It seems like this is going to become only an even more pressing issue as time goes on. I think it's just unfortunate that energy crisis is talked about in mainstream news until a major tragic event like Texas happens.
Well, yeah, we don't understand these systems. We don't know how they work, nor do we want to know how they work until they fail.
So Moving on, Hannah talked earlier about renewable energy, but I want to touch on one other option that is off-the-grid living. These methods aren't necessarily accessible to everyone, but I wanted to share another alternative to energy grids here in the U.S. So off-the-grid energy means you are not connected to a power system or utility company. This can be nice in situations like the winter storm because energy can be saved for later use. Some of the benefits of off-the-grid energy can be that it can be more reliable for situations like the winter storm because of the ability to store energy. Another benefit would be that it can be more cost efficient over a long period of time. It is definitely not a cheap or incredibly accessible option to set up solar panels or micro hydro systems, but you can save money in the long run. Off-grid also allows you to have control over your energy consumption and is a great way to achieve energy conservation. Some disadvantages of off-the-grid energy is that it can be a change in your lifestyle in order to reduce your energy consumption, and also the initial cost, as I discussed, is pretty expensive, but the savings in the long run, I believe, are financially smart. Another disadvantage would be that if you have a weather-dependent system, it might not be as efficient, and you also have to use batteries, which the production of batteries is not entirely environmentally sound.
Okay. Thank you so much, Sloan, Hannah, and Eleanor. We're going to take a short break, but we hope you stay tuned because up next we will conclude with a discussion of what it could politically and infrastructurally require to improve the American energy grid and then discuss some mutual aid solutions to the energy crisis.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we will discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Every Thursday morning at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Hundred years ago, Vivaldi wrote The Four Seasons. It portrays the natural world from birdsong to summer storms. But the warming climate could radically alter the natural world by 2050. So a new version of The Four Seasons has been altered too.
We really wanted to walk that line between being too ridiculously catastrophic and kind of meaningfully changing this to make it sound what we think it might feel like to live in that time.
Tim Devine is with AKQA. The design agency partnered with composers and scientists to develop an algorithm that translates projected environmental changes into musical changes. It allows them to create localized versions for any place where the piece is performed. In the version played by Australia's Sydney Symphony Orchestra, missing notes reflect declining bird populations, and the summer storm is more intense and prolonged. For listeners, the result is familiar but unsettling, and a warning about how the world could change if nothing is done to reduce global warming. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in to Eco Radio. We are four KU Environmental Studies students here to discuss a few of the complicated issues surrounding the American energy grid. Earlier in the podcast, we talked about the pressing issues facing America energy infrastructure. We also discussed some ways that climate change makes these infrastructural issues worse over time. We also talked about what it means when the grid fails and who is most negatively affected by energy crises.
So to wrap things up, Eleanor and Madison will get into the politics of energy crises and discuss some hopeful potential solutions to these issues.
So, Madison, do you want to tell us more about the issues of politics related to the energy crisis?
Yeah. So I do just want to start off by giving a quick disclaimer that I am definitely not an economist and not even a business student, but I am a person who consumes energy every day, and I'm definitely concerned with the existence of what seems to be some major failures happening within the energy sector right now. So to start off, I wanted to explain my understanding of a concept I've come across in economics called a natural monopoly. And natural monopolies are considered to be monopolies that happen when there are extremely high cost barriers that are required to enter into an industry. So basically, not anyone can just come up with the money and the funds needed to build a huge power plant and power lines and other energy infrastructure and then call themselves a utility company. So natural monopolies are considered monopolies of scale. The theory being that the bigger that a power plant can be, the cheaper that the power will be for consumers. And this was the justification that was used to allow the existence of natural monopolies to exist in the energy industry for decades. I think that this natural monopoly concept is really interesting, but unfortunate at the same time. And I think that it runs completely counter to a lot of the capitalistic ideas and instincts that so many Americans hold dear and consider this country to have been founded on or consider this country's economy to operate on. I can definitely see why there is so much interest in keeping utility costs low for consumers, but it seems counterintuitive and definitely regressive to allow these massive monopolies to exist in the way that they do today, which I'll get a little bit more into here in a minute. I do want to note that there was a wave of deregulations that happened in the 1990s, and that is what created the extremely complicated energy system that we see today. This system is far too complicated for me to get into all of the detail about right now, but essentially what we see is that consumers have little to no choice between different utility providers in their area, and in a given area there are generally only about two utility providers that people can choose from. And as a result, we see a lot of suffering and a lot of issues with energy infrastructure, like Sloan discussed in the previous section, and as Eleanor explained, that we saw during the Texas crisis. And I do want to emphasize that I think issues of monopoly are definitely on a lot of people's minds right now, as we've seen big tech facing some different legal action being taken against them. And so I think it's on people's minds that monopolies can be undemocratic and that they can stifle innovation.
So what do you think some potential solutions to these problems could be, Madison?
Yeah, that's a great but really complicated question.
Yeah, how are we going to fix the big problem of a natural monopoly?
Yeah, well, to me, the bottom line is that the current system places way too much emphasis on maximizing profits for these utility companies that I've described, the companies who have these monopolies. And as Hannah explained, the technology exists right now to create efficient and cost-effective clean energy. But that technology isn't being prioritized and it's not being installed in our energy infrastructure. And additionally, the monopolistic power that utilities companies have makes consumers beholden to their priorities, and therefore innovation is discouraged. There seems to be little to no incentive to move towards clean energy without the competition to do so. And I do want to say that basically everything I've talked about thus far has to do with various market mechanisms and a failure of what is supposed to be quote-unquote natural market processes. But I want to say that I think that this process has been anything but natural. I think that these failures are the result of decades-long political decisions with various political and economic motivations. Unfortunately, I'm not here to offer the perfect solution to these problems that we've talked about, but I do want to emphasize that different political decisions can and must be made in order to get people out of the mess of our current energy infrastructure, and this needs to happen fast. There ought to be big, thoughtful, and creative solutions in order to ensure reliable and affordable utilities to all Americans in the very near future. As the Anthropocene Institute explains, the new age of renewable energy that we are entering into will change almost everything about the status quo of the grid. We know that the current system harms the well-being of consumers, and that the technology exists to solve these harms. So in order to bridge this gap, I feel it's not a question of if the energy grid will need to be overhauled, but it's a question of when it will be overhauled. Talking about the details of energy infrastructure can be really boring at times, terms, and it's not the most glamorous subject, but personally, I feel it would be pretty powerful if a politician who was running for office or who's currently in office were actually to address these structural issues that will inevitably continue to harm predominantly poorer communities and communities of color, but also anyone who consumes energy. And taking the charge to improve the quality of life for American consumers is a matter of political willpower and movement building. And I think achieving decarbonization of the grid is entirely on the table. So, with these things being said, now that I've shared what I've learned about the politics of energy utilities, we're going to have Eleanor share what she knows about organizing and mutual aid solutions in times of energy crisis.
Yeah, thank you so much for that, Madison. There were amazing organizations on the ground in Texas that even here in Kansas, I was able to hear about their impact and I was able to support them. To me, these organizations and mutual aid networks appear very obviously crucial in the Texas situation, because who knows how many more people could have gone without electricity, food, water, or a space to stay. The number of people who died from hypothermia or other causes could have been a lot higher as well, sadly. Just to name a few of the efforts, Mutual Aid Houston, Mutual Aid Austin, Feed the People, Para Mi Gente Mutual Aid. These mutual aid groups and many more, many of which are run by people of color, were and still are doing a range of things, from providing warming shelters, food distribution, distributing clean water, getting hotels for people, as well as sharing winter and COVID supplies. These are just a few of the ways the mutual aid efforts showed up. And I really feel like these community efforts stepped up and responded to the lack of government response during this winter storm. So I bring these up because when the energy grid failed and the government didn't really respond, tons of people, mainly marginalized groups, were just left to fend for themselves. But these communities pooled all that they had, and the action they were taking drew a national response, and people all over the country were able to donate and support them. So just to give a quick definition, mutual aid is a network of community members that have a shared belief that power structures aren't serving them or a shared acknowledgement of injustices. For example, the absence of aid from the government in the Texas situation. So mutual aid efforts redistribute and share resources to help people in their own communities. They aren't relying on government to respond, but more focused on direct action. Mutual aid is based in solidarity and community cooperation, working together to meet each other's needs. These efforts are really important because all of these disasters continue to happen, like the winter storm, someone needs to show up for these people when structures of power don't. While acknowledging the winter storm and the effects it caused on Texas communities, it is also important to discuss the other time of year, summer. Heat events in Texas and around the country is what I'm talking about. Studies conducted by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or the CDC, as we've heard many times in the past couple months, have shown that exposure to extreme heat can increase discomfort and fatigue, cause heat cramps, and increase emergency room visits and hospitalizations, and it can also kill. So not only are these average temperatures rising, but extreme weather events are too. Cities like Dallas can also have an increase of extreme temperatures because of the albedo of cities, which is a reflection of the sun off of a surface. That is, there's more reflection in cities. An increase in severity and frequency and a general rise in temperature will call for more public health programs. And as the CDC says, learning about how to prepare for and respond to extreme heat events will help protect our communities, especially the most vulnerable populations, from avoidable death and hardship. With all that said, I just sort of wanted to recognize the efforts on the ground, mutual aid efforts. As climate change progresses, extreme weather events like the winter storm will increase as well. These events affect the homeless population, low-income communities, and people of color the most. And as long as our structures of government and society are centered around white supremacy and capitalism, these mutual aid efforts will continue to be needed in communities, and they will continue to show up during times of crisis like the situation in Texas.
I feel like it's hard for elite structures to be able to even, like, comprehend what's going on, because they can avoid all the inconveniences that come with blackouts. Like, blackouts aren't this devastating effect for them. Like, as we all saw, Ted Cruz going to Cancun during the blackouts in Texas, whereas, like, the lower classes and the affected communities lack that governmental representation to understand how devastating a blackout can be.
I agree. I mean, it's obviously extremely tragic that elite powers – structures and the infrastructure have failed so many people, I'd say the majority of people who aren't able to afford generators and just get out of a time of blackout, like Sloan has explained. But at the same time, I think that it's kind of empowering to see this level of community organizing that's happening in the face of disasters and to see people in solidarity with one another and forming these mutual aid efforts. So thank you for sharing that, Eleanor.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. It's totally empowering. So we talked about the benefits of mutual aid plenty and how this can be a way for people to contribute to their communities when governments don't. And I found some awesome local mutual aid efforts in Lawrence or the greater KC area. And I invite listeners to get involved or donate to the following organizations. So one in the Lawrence area is Lawrence Free Gin, or LFK Eats on Venmo. It's a community fridge and pantry. Other ones that are located in the KC area are the Mary Outlaw, as well as Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, the Kansas City Community Care Fund.
Thank you so much for providing those resources for us, Eleanor. So just to recap our show, we began by summarizing the events of the energy crisis that happened in Texas last month. Hannah then gave us a background about what the energy currently looks like and how the grid, how climate change will continue to put stress on our energy infrastructure.
Sloan told us more about what it means when the grid fails and who is affected the most. Then we heard Madison explain how energy utilities monopolize the market and can stifle necessary innovation.
Finally, we just heard Eleanor explain more about what mutual aid projects are and how they have helped communities who are affected most by energy blackouts and crises.
We want to let you know that there will be information on local mutual aid projects and how to donate to them listed in the description of this show on EcoRadio's website, which is www.kkfi.org. And we invite listeners to check out these resources and learn how to make a difference in our community.
Thank you all so much for taking time out of your day and spending this hour with us today. We hope you were able to learn something and you had a good time and you enjoyed yourself today. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for everything.
Yeah. Thank you so much,
thank
Teresa.
You. Yeah.
Support for KKFI comes from Community Lending of America. Their Community Minute for March spotlights One Good Meal, a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing hot meals to seniors and homebound individuals regardless of income. Since its beginning in 1995, One Good Meal has continuously served midday meals Monday through Friday to seniors and handicapped individuals regardless of income. Learn more about One Good Meal all this month at Community Lending of America's website, clakc.com.
Eco Radio is produced by a team of collaborators, including yours truly, Craig Lubo, Teresa Wilkie, Dave Bennett, and Brent Ragsdale. Thanks to Ryan Porky for our theme music. I'm Richard Mabian, reminding you to give your feedback by contacting us at ecoradio@gmail.com or reaching out to Eco Radio KC, our Facebook page.